Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I am the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. And I am known here for doing interviews with cutting edge tech companies like, well, Dropbox. Its founder was on here early on. Founders of Airbnb were on, founder of SendGrid and so on. But this is the story of how a non-techie founder had an idea and built it into an online business. Wait till you see the simple way that he got started when he launched his business. Breck Palumbo is the founder of DistressedPro.com and the creator of Bank Prospector, a sales intelligence software. Banks own real estate. He shows investors how to acquire the real estate and debt from the banks. I don't think I did a great job of explaining what it does. We will get deeper into it. Before we started, he warned me. He said, no one outside of my business understands what the business is. We'll explain it. First, I want to say two things. Number one, this interview is sponsored by Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. He probably understands every part of this business, and he definitely understands the startup business. If you're an entrepreneur, need a lawyer, I'll tell you later on why you want to go to walkercorporatelaw.com. Let me say it again clearly, walkercorporatelaw.com. And the second thing I need to do is welcome Breck. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hey, let's jump right into it. This first version of the product that you sold was what?
It was a PDF.
PDF. Just a document. Right. What was on this document?
So the way this works is that banks file reports. And inside those reports, there's intelligence that you can gain into what's happening inside the bank. It tells you what they have for bad assets that they need to sell, whether or not they're healthy enough to sell, these kinds of things. And they're just line items in pages and pages of CSVs. That you can download.
Now, I mean, I could just go to the bank and I could get the CSV way. You mean at the time you could go to the bank, get the CSV file and just comb it.
So let me back up. So banks, any banks that are insured in any way, FDIC, all report through a central aggregator. Okay. Right now it's called, they report now all through the FFIEC. And okay. So they transmit each quarter, they transmit all of their relevant financial information, and then that's compiled. It's delivered to the FDIC. They have spreadsheets on the stuff. They run some calculations on it, and then that's available to the public.
Okay.
But it's really unwieldy, and it's difficult to deal with. And so what I did is I learned about what those numbers mean, and then I took that and it was so basic. It was a mail merge in from Excel to Word. I put together a spreadsheet with it, did a merge to a Word document, printed it to a PDF, and then I sold this report as a product where it'd give you a breakdown of each bank's all the numbers that you would need to know. In order to know who a good prospect for you would be.
And a good prospect meaning who's a good bank for you?
Right. Well, at the time, we were in the crisis, as you may recall. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of banks being closed. There were a lot of banks that were not necessarily in a place where they could sell. And I would put your audience right to sleep.
You mean where they could sell their property or sell debt to you?
Yeah. So what happened was they put a lot of debt on the street, right? And then they had to go out and collect on it. And some people would approach this problem by buying the debt from the banks, and then others would buy the real estate, what happens is that banks go through a process. The debt is late. It goes into a thing called non-accrual. That means it's not accruing interest anymore. Then eventually they'll foreclose on it. If it's real estate, they'll book it in. Or else the other way that they get rid of it is they just sell the debt. Sell the bad debt.
And what investors wanted to know from you is where could they go buy this debt or buy this property from banks who are eager to sell?
That's right.
Got
or list it. If you're a broker, you might go and list their debt for them.
I see. Their debt and then someone else would buy it from you.
That's right.
Okay. And so all you did was get data that was available to anyone and you made sense of it by using Excel and Word and the mail merge combination of the two.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's it.
And the reason that you were able to do it is because your background is in real estate. I heard you were an auctioneer. Were you the kind of person who did the hey, blah, 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 that whole thing?
I did. Yeah. You did it better than me right there.
Really? But,
yeah.
Can you do it? How would it go?
You know, I knew you were going to ask me this.
I would love to be able to talk that fast.
And there's a few different ways to do this. I'm by no means any kind of champion bid caller, and I haven't done it in now almost coming up on 2 years. But I'm up in the Northeast, and I sold a lot of commercial property. When I'm selling something for $1 million or $2 million, I'm not at you fast. We take time. I'll walk you around the corner, squeeze you for a price. We're bidding in hundreds of thousands of dollars of increments, and it's not that kind of speed like a cattle auction that you would expect. So
I see. It's much more. Yeah. It's much much more civil.
It's much more. It's more like the British do it.
I see. Okay. Yeah. And so when the crisis happened, what year was this?
What year when the crisis happened?
Yeah. We're talking about 98?
We're talking about 2000. And, yeah, exactly, 2000. So I started getting, I was in real estate since the dot-com bust. So if we're going to go back that far. And then as my career progressed in real estate, I worked with a lot of investors and developers. One thing that I started to see was just some really frothy kinds of deals, like guys doing deals, no money down, and bigger construction projects. I said, this smells wrong. This is not going to go the right way. And so I started getting positioned for the turn. And so I got an auctioneer's license and all that. This is in late 2006. At that time, there wasn't really much for me to do, other than to call on folks because everything was still going up. So Bank Prospector, I didn't actually launch that until, the PDF and whatnot, until 2009, the summer of 2009.
And what made you decide to go and do that, to put this all into a PDF?
It was so difficult to get some transparency and make sense of who I should be talking to with all the thousands of institutions out there, that I thought that if this is where the game is at, if the lenders are the ones who are in control, then that's where the money is going to be made for the next several years if you're doing the kind of business that I'm doing, brokering or as an auctioneer. And I can't be the only person who's thinking this.
What about this idea that if it's just a PDF, anyone can copy it? There's no copy protection. If it's just a PDF, one of your customers could look at it and go, this is what I paid for, just this document?
So I don't think I was thinking about the former, but the latter was a major concern for me. So when I first put that out, I was nervous as all get out. I mean, I figured everyone was going to want a refund and it was going to be, totally useless to them. And that was not what I found. That wasn't the case. But I did think about that. I didn't think about the other part, mostly because there's some barrier to entry there. Cause you've got to take some time to make sense of what all this stuff is. I mean, if you ever looked at what these spreadsheets look like, it would make absolutely no sense. It's codes, and I mean, it would make no sense to anyone unless you took the time and really invested in understanding what that was.
How did you know that people needed that they wanted you to spend the time to do that for them?
Well, this was the year when commercial real estate transactions dropped by like 93%.
Okay.
I mean, I had gone from a really, really busy business to not at all, and I was not alone in that. I mean, everyone that I knew in the business at that time, we had been making hay for a while, and it was not that
anymore. So why did that lead you to say, hey, you know what everyone needs is a PDF that shows all the available properties and loans that they could buy?
Yeah, well, not properties and loans. It was a little bit different than that. But the reason, and it's not everybody that needs it, but a certain subset of people need it. So if you wanted to continue to transact and that's how you're going to make your fee, and the only people who are transacting are the banks, then that's where you need to be. And that was my estimation of the situation anyway at the time. And so I figured that it's not a game for everybody. You got to kind of be, you got to know what you're doing a little bit. But if you did, then if you had this sort of data in hand, then you could really capitalize on what would otherwise be a really terrible time to be in that business.
Okay.
So does that make sense?
A little bit. You had the PDF. It's time to get customers. How'd you do it?
I had a friend who is a member of an organization who sent an email for me. And it went out to a few thousand people, and about 1,000 people clicked, and I sold a few.
And he got to make a share of your sales?
No, we weren't that advanced.
He just did
at
as a friend.
We were buddies. He just posted the
How
thing.
How big was his list?
I think it was about 5,000 people.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. And you were selling the document for how much?
I think it was about $200, as I recall.
$200.
Yeah.
Do you remember how many sales you made from that one email that went out?
I did, all told, and I may have messed with the price a little bit, but all told, it was between $1,000 and $2,000. It wasn't a ton of money. It was like, okay.
Was it enough to encourage you and make you feel like this is something worth pursuing? Or did you at that point say, what am I doing here?
Yeah. So that's actually probably the big mistake. If I was going to go back and nail one, is I considered that validation and then was like, oh, good. So I see. Software.
I got $2,000. That means this is the answer.
Yeah. That means that, well, this was clunky and it was ugly and it was messy, but people are spending money on it. So I should move forward.
Why is that a mistake? It feels like it is validation. If a couple of dozen people, what'd you sell? You sold about a dozen of them?
I think it worked out to about a dozen, and I'd done some different things with the pricing. But yeah, it was about $1,500. But I think the mistake that I made there was I should have just kept selling the PDF. There was no reason.
Oh, I see. The mistake was to take it to the next level and say, now I have to create software.
Yes.
Why do you think you did that if it worked so well?
I was hot to make a piece of software.
Because it feels like software is worth charging for. A PDF feels a little small.
That's exactly right. I was embarrassed by this thing. I didn't have any way to protect it. It was I wasn't sure how much people were using it or getting any value from it. And for all those reasons, I thought, this should really be, software.
You know, I'm looking at an early version of your site, maybe even the first real version of it, and it looks to me like you were using AMember, if I could read the data right.
Yeah.
Right? So did you go into a membership site before or after you did the PDF?
So I did some weird, janky things. I kind of duct taped this FrankenApp together. I took AMember and I used that to control... Well, the version of the site that you're looking at is not where I sold the original PDF. I don't even remember what that domain was at this point, but that was I used some Joomla thing with a PayPal button. I just probably spent way too much time on it because I wanted to look, legit. Mm-hmm. And so, what you're looking at is probably not that, but I did then when I launched in August that year. That what we're talking about with the PDF is like late June, July. When I launched in August that year, I did go with an AMember plugin. Yeah.
Because you wanted to start to get consistent revenue from memberships.
Exactly.
So it was first PDF, then membership, then, hey, let's make software because that's a real legitimate business.
Sort of. The membership was the software. So what you would get access to, I used AMember to, you could use that to plug it into a custom PHP script, and you could also plug it into WordPress, so it could manage the whole thing. So that's what I did that.
Gotcha. The software that you created, what was it going to do?
This was going to show you which banks you should call on. It was awful.
What made it awful? I mean, it seems like it's the same thing you did by PDF manually, you now automate it through software. So why was it awful?
I remember at one point I logged in and there was this, I guess we'll call it an error, but some guy had just like put his name in there. He was, one of the developers and it just like said, it said like, hi, Mahmood, or something like that on a random page. I was using LinkedIn plugins that were way before they had any kind of decent API. It was terrible.
I see. So terrible that your developer left his name in the site by accident.
Hanging around out there. Yeah, it was terrible. Yeah.
It's kind of like a doctor leaving a clamp inside you after sewing it back up. I see.
Yeah, it was really ugly.
What did it cost you to have this done?
I think it cost $3,000.
Okay, not bad. So a little bit more than you made from selling the PDF the first go round.
Right.
How long did it take?
I started that, I guess it took about six to eight weeks.
Okay. Yeah. And during the 6 to 8 weeks, were you still selling PDFs?
Six to eight.
That's what I meant. Not 68. Yeah. Six to 8 weeks. Time. Were you still selling the PDF?
No. Foolishly.
So there is the big lesson in here that first version that worked, that people bought, you should have continued to sell because they were buying it. We need to stop being embarrassed by that first thing that we create.
Yeah. If I could do it again, there's no way I would have launched into software. I would have made four different versions of the PDF. I would have sold that for a long time until it didn't sell anymore. So, yeah.
Right. And then start to create software and keep it as simple maybe as the PDF first version.
Yeah.
You were selling your software for $80 a month, right?
I was, yeah.
It took you 6 to 8 weeks to launch it. How long did it take you to get your first customer?
I got my first customer at the end of, so I launched August 30th, and I think I got my first customer at the end of September, September 30th.
Okay, that's not bad. How'd you get your first customer?
I spoke at a local real estate investment group meetup.
Wow. Yeah. And you actually pitched from the talk.
So badly, but
because?
Yes. It was kind of like, because I was embarrassed, you know, it's funny because I've been in sales forever. But doing it from stage where I was, you know, teaching people and then I'm supposed to close and get you to the back of the room and stuff. I had a hard time with it. I didn't do it. I was very soft on it. I was like, I didn't do that right. Yeah.
All right. Well, not bad that you got a customer. Was the customer happy?
He hung around a few months, I think.
Okay. Yeah. And did you make the mistake that a lot of us make when we sell things monthly before they're fully ready, where you didn't contact the guy and say, what do you think of this? How do you like it? Thanks for joining, that kind of thing?
Well, I mean, I knew him. I signed him up personally. He came, he sat down next to me. I typed the thing in. He had my phone number and all that. So I think his name was Rocky. And so did I check to see how he was using it and if it was useful for him? No, I don't think so. I don't think I did.
Is it because of the thing that I just mentioned where, especially if you know Rocky, you feel a little embarrassed that it's not perfect. You don't want to go to, you do, right? But what we need to do is we do need to call them up and check in with them. And I have to keep pushing myself, frankly, when I know to launch that MVP and not be embarrassed by what people think of me.
Yeah.
It's hard to contact those people afterwards and say, what do you think? Because I'm almost putting myself out there and saying, this is so great that I need to know what you think about it. And right. All right. But at least you got it out there. And then it was time for you to grow it. Is that when you started blogging, interviewing? What'd you do next?
Yeah, both of those things. I started blogging and interviewing.
Why interviewing? Most people will understand blogging. I think very few people still get the power of interviewing. Why did you decide to interview so early on?
Podcasts are a lot of what helped get me to a point where I could even do this business. So I had been listening to all the usual stuff. I forget exactly what was available in 2009, but I was listening to all of it that I could get my hands on, and I knew the power that it had on me. And so I didn't see anyone doing it in this particular like narrow niche. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that'd be a good way to get it out there.
Okay.
I also wanted to validate it. I wanted to show that people actually were making money this way. Like this was a legitimate angle to take in your real estate business.
Oh, you wanted to interview your customers or people like your customers to show what they did. I got it.
That's right.
And was it originally just your customers or was it people you wanted to be your customers?
It was experts in the field. Most of the time they were my customers, but just experts.
Okay.
Yeah.
That sounds great. I love that approach. I think by interviewing your customers, you get to know them. By interviewing your customers, others get to see, as you said, some case studies and get to see how successful they could be. I think Mixergy started that way. I wanted the world to see who was coming out to my events when I was doing events.
Yeah.
And it was a good way to highlight the events by highlighting the people who are coming to them. Did it work for you, interviewing?
I think so. I think it did. I get a lot of qualitative feedback on that. I don't have a good number I can point to for that, but I have a lot of people who tell me that they love the interviews and that they're really helpful and it's why they bought and that kind of thing, for sure. Yeah.
Did you happen to take my Interview Your Heroes course at any point?
The
mini one that I did? No, you didn't. Okay.
No, I did sign up for your course for a while.
I know. You were there for 3 months and I made the same mistake with you by not checking in and saying, hey, what do you think? I think it was 3 months, maybe less.
You know what? I thought it was more than that, but you know, I don't know if you want to talk about this on the show, so I guess...
Oh, no, it sounds like you're about to give me negative feedback. I'll take it on the show. I feel safer getting stuff on the show than I do anywhere else.
I found it... Well, a couple of things. One is, you know, I'm super busy, so when I sit down and I want to get trained up on something, it's usually a specific thing that I'm looking to tackle right then. Mm-hmm. And I found it difficult to get exactly what I needed easily in that way. And, it was kind of... a buffet, which is nice, but I think I'd almost pay more to have them compartmentalized so that, you know, now I'm going to do a video training series. I need to go learn what all the experts at Mixergy are doing for a video training series or for copywriting or for whatever it is. But I just didn't have, I wasn't sitting down watching the videos on a regular
curation
basis.
Is a big issue. And you're right, it actually was for a lot longer than that. I only found one record for a moment, and now I see a whole lot more than that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a big issue for me, and I need to figure out how to solve that. You're right.
I actually kind of followed your model to some degree, which is I started putting the interviews out and then putting them into a vault. Mm-hmm. So they'd be out for a while, and then anyone could hear them, and then they go away. And I put one price on the thing, which I think now in retrospect, as I've been working through things over the last 6-8 months, sorting this out, I've discovered that I really left a lot on the table doing it that way.
By charging once for everything as opposed to monthly?
Or as opposed to having tiers. I had one price, and for a while I had a monthly or an annual price, and it was $50 a month or $300 a year. And then... which is way too low to begin with. But the other thing that I've discovered is that I have really different people coming to the site. And so over the last year or so, I've really embarked on a discovery process to get to the bottom of who's there and what they need and what they want. And I have really some tiers, and I had not been addressing them. And the price was so low that the people who were really serious, who I was used to doing business with, I don't think could even... I mean, couldn't take it seriously. And the people who were really just starting off in the business or didn't have a way to, or, you know, just getting started, it was too much money for them. So I made some real mistakes that way. And I think that doing just a one price like that is, it's not optimum.
I see what you mean. Yeah. I noticed that too. It's so strange that if you undercharge, people don't take you seriously.
Oh, yeah.
And if you overcharge, of course, we understand that you're out of reach to some people. But
yeah.
I used to think, well, that's just marketing speak. No one really, if you undercharge, is going to be upset. You're going to capture them anyway. And then I saw the way that I evaluate things. If, for example, a meal is only 75 cents somewhere, I think that's a little ghetto.
Yeah.
I'm not going to have
yeah.
that. I don't care what's in it. I don't care if they have good intentions. And the same thing for online content and software.
Yeah.
Except for the app store. The mobile app store, it doesn't matter. All right.
Right.
So you did interviewing, and I'm glad to see that it worked for you. I'm especially glad to see that the model that worked for me translated over to you. You also did some blogging. How did that go?
It went okay. It wasn't a raging success, but there weren't a lot of people talking about these really narrow things, so I did get some traffic.
Okay. And you copied Patio 11's playbook?
That is when I finally started really getting some traffic.
Okay.
Yeah. So what I did was, and by that, we should say, he's got the bingo card creator, right? So
this
he's
is
got
Patrick
all these.
Patrick McKenzie. He's got bingocardcreator.com. And one of the things that he did was he noticed that teachers who use bingo cards to teach need bingo cards of all 50 states or bingo cards that teach the names of the leaders of Japanese leaders or et cetera. So he automated a process for creating a landing page for each of those topics.
Right.
That would give people a bingo card for each of those topics. And of course, be indexed by Google. So anytime you did a search for 50 states bingo card, you might come up with one of his landing pages. I don't know if that's specifically a phrase that he has, but he didn't just do that. He taught people how to do it. He came to Mixergy to teach it. He taught on SEO courses and sites how to do it. And several people have done really well with it. How did you use that model for yourself?
So what I did is I took the database with every bank and every credit union, and I created those same pages.
So there was a page for every bank and every credit union.
Yeah, that's right.
And what was the keyword that you attached to it?
Do I want to go all the way into that for my competitors? I don't know.
Okay, don't do it then. Does it still work to this day?
Yeah.
It does. I was wondering about that. Did Google make some change to the algorithm or something that made it
all work? I'm knocking on wood and haven't been hit by any barnyard animals of any kind, no penguins or pandas or anything like that.
And was this traffic going to distressedpro.com?
Sure, yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. So those are the two things that worked for you. What's one thing that didn't work for you? You spent some time on it and it just didn't pan out.
Yeah. Hiring writers was, I thought that it was really good. It felt good. I had a system. People were, I had articles coming out all the time, and they had, and then it just didn't get any traffic. It wasn't good.
Interesting. I wonder why. What is it about finding writers that's so hard? It is hard.
It is hard. And I don't know. It just did. And he was a great writer and he had experience in the business. But it seems like for certain things, the audience wants to hear from me, you know? And so it just didn't. I spent a lot of time and money on it. And as I went back, I should have paid closer attention to it as I moved through it, but I didn't. And so when I finally sat down to say, hey, is this working? You know, so many months later, it just really wasn't. You know, there's a few things that get some traffic, but mostly it did not.
As you're doing all this, is the software improving, or is it still at the state where the equipment, where your developer's name is stuck there and LinkedIn isn't working, et cetera?
So I'm actually, as you and I speak, there are a couple of guys who are working on the fourth iteration of this. So I've been through a few rounds. The newest one is night and day.
What about the second round? Was the second round any good?
Second round was a little better.
What'd you do to make the second round better than the first?
The first round, I had to actually go and manually import the CSVs to get the data in. It was a horror show. It was terrible. Fortunately for me, not long after I opened this, the FFIEC, the federal agency, came up with an API. That was a big help. We started getting that automatically. We got a much better, plugged into data.com, which used to be called Jigsaw, plugged into LinkedIn in a better way. And so it was just, I mean, it wasn't even the same. It was a wholesale change.
Wait, you can
change.
Plug into data.com, which used to be Jigsaw, which is a site where you can go in and type a name of a person and get their email address for a price?
Yeah.
I see. And so you were able to not just give bank information, but the name of the person at the bank and their potential contact information.
That's right. Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So then I bundle all that with training on how to do it.
Got it. Before I get to the training, I want to do two things. One is my eyes were going to something. I think I know what the keyword is. Tell me, I'm not going to say it to the audience, but I want to know for my own self, is my researchability strong? How is that? Is it that phrase? Is that one of the phrases that you use? I'm showing it in examples.
Yeah, that's one of them. Yeah.
Okay. Good. I promise not to say anything to the audience, but because I don't want to reveal your stuff, but I do like to know that we can do solid research here at Mixergy.
Yeah, it's like that and two other keywords basically make up 60% of my traffic today.
Okay. Yeah, I got a little bit of info here, but obviously not as much as you.
Yeah.
So actually, the second thing I need to do is say to the audience, you can screw up with your software, and that is perfectly fine. In fact, that's part of the business, especially when you're getting started. But when you're getting started, if you screw up with the way that you have a partnership agreement with your co-founder, the way that you set up your company, it is so much harder to undo. It's so much harder to untangle, especially if you're arguing with your co-founder, especially if something big happens and you need to move to the next step with your co-founder. Especially when something big happens, it's hard to undo mistakes that you made legally in the beginning. So what do you do? talk to my sponsor, Scott Edward Walker of walkercorporatelaw.com. When you're getting started, he can start you up right by making sure that you have the right agreement with your co-founder, by making sure that you incorporate properly, by making sure that you do it so much smarter than the do-it-yourself guys ever could. Saves you a lot of problems, saves you a lot of trouble for just a little bit more money than starting on your own and a lot more credibility. Why does Scott do it? Because he's in the business of doing that? No way. He's not competing with those lawyers who just get you started. The reason he does it is he knows if he gets you started right, when it's time for you to do a deal where you're raising money, you're going to know that Scott Edward Walker is the lawyer to go to. Like many other entrepreneurs, when it's time to sell, when it's time to buy, when it's time to raise money, when it's time to do all those big transactions, he is the lawyer that many entrepreneurs here in San Francisco, in the tech world in general, turn to. And so he'll help you out early on to get you set up properly later on. So no matter which place you're in, if you're just getting started or if you're at that stage where you need to do a big transaction, raising money, selling your company, buying company, etc., talk to the people at walkercorporatelaw.com. So there it is, walkercorporatelaw.com. And Google him. Google Scott Edward Walker. You'll see how many other people say very positive things about him. It's not just because he's my sponsor. He's my sponsor because so many people have said positive things about him. Walkercorporatelaw.com. The course that you said, how does this mini course fit into your vision?
So what I discovered pretty quick was that nobody knew what the hell they were doing with the data. It didn't make any, you know, they didn't, I knew what it all meant, and I had some information about what it all meant, but really it's nobody knew what the hell was going on. And so I was getting a lot of questions about how to use it, what the numbers meant and all that. And so, so I knew that I needed to educate people about that. And so one of the things that I did was an email mini course. And so it's 14 emails that you get in a row when you first sign up. And basically I walk you through everything that you need to know in order to do the entire thing by yourself. So you wouldn't need my software at all. You can just go do it manually if your time's not valuable, I guess. And it's been really powerful. People write and thank me all the time for providing this. I can't believe you're not charging for this and things like that. But the fact is that, and I did want to really deliver like serious value, probably went too far, probably should have more sales in there and should still tweak that. But it's played a huge role. It drives most of my business for sure.
You do it all through Infusionsoft, right?
I have been, yeah. I don't want to badmouth Infusionsoft, but I've been looking around lately.
Why? It's okay. They're open to issues that they've had. Others have talked about it here.
Yeah. The cart situation is not good. Their deliverability is, I don't think, is great. I mean, they have some good automations in there, but there's a lot of like little janky things where it's like, this was definitely designed by a developer and it's not great. So I'm looking at
email will not hit the inbox of your recipient predictably enough.
Or good. Yeah. It goes to spam or different things like that. I have people tell me all the time, they're not getting things they signed up for. So I'm looking at, Rob Walling's Drip. So
at what?
Get Drip.
Oh, Get Drip. Yes, yeah. Rob Walling's system. I didn't know that Rob Walling. Oh, I know he does that, but you then give up the automation. You cannot have somebody say, "I do this."
No, not anymore. That's actually why I'm looking at it. Before, I didn't look at it before because he didn't have that, but now he's building in all of the automation.
Got it.
So now I'm looking at that.
And what is it about the shopping cart with Infusionsoft shopping cart that you don't like?
It's got way too many fields. It takes you to another domain. It's there's a
oh yeah, taking slew you to another stuff. Domain is so bad. I don't know why I can't just put it on my own domain the way I do Stripe.
Exactly. It doesn't go through Stripe. Don't integrate with Stripe.
That is the worst part. I'm okay with them going with users going to another site. I don't like that I can't use Stripe. I love Stripe. I want to make out. I want to French kiss Stripe. It's so good.
Me too.
What else did I want to say about that? Oh, I want to say this, that if anyone is a member and you want to understand how to automate your emails or how to send emails out, the guy to go to is Jermaine Griggs, and we have him as one of the teachers in Mixergy Premium. Just type in Jermaine and you're going to see him. Or frankly, Google him. You'll see how great the guy is. Yeah. All right. So you were doing all that. One of your goals is to have recurring revenue. Did you have that recurring revenue? Did it start to come in?
Yeah, it did. So last year around this time, I decided that my monthly customers were a pain in the ass, basically. They were the most demanding. They asked for refunds the most. And I deduced that this was because that they had just kind of limped in. That was all they could afford. And that was the type of folks I was attracting at the price level. So I did shut that down last year, although I still have people who are still on it, have been for years. So I guess the recurring really only has come from the annual subscriptions over the last year or so. And it's been okay. It's been good. I'm working on moving away from that, but it's definitely been
okay. You mean to a one-time charge?
I'm looking at quarterly and annual payments now on a three-tier system.
I see. Yeah. You know what? I've talked to so many SaaS entrepreneurs just privately who are in the audience who will say the same thing you've just said, that the monthly is a pain in the butt, too many cancellations, yeah, too many small dollar amounts. Annual is where it's at, and that's what they're moving towards. Yeah. And I know, frankly, even for me, annual would do more revenue, but I want more people and not more revenue. I have a different model than SaaS. More revenue with fewer people seems to work better for software as a service, and it makes it easier to do customer service too. You don't have a lot of customers. You have a few high-paying customers who are worth
more than
the small. Yeah, that makes sense. I think everyone who does software needs to at least consider doing that.
Yeah.
What did you do to become better at project management? You're not a guy who lives and breathes code, like the guy who I interviewed yesterday who told me that he coded when he was 7 years old. How does a non-developer know how to manage developers and get what he needs out of them?
Yeah. That was hard. It's still hard. I mean, that's probably the most challenging part of this business for me as a non-technical
Can you give me some tips, founder? Some of the things that you've learned about doing it right?
Yeah, you need to really document the heck out of everything. I mean, you can't, anytime I leave something up to chance or to a developer decision, most of the time I end up wanting to change it when I get the deliverable. And now what I do is I do really, really detailed mock-ups. And I used to do them, kind of still do them. I used to do them just in Pages, which is like Word for Mac.
Yep.
And I would go and I'd find I'd take the template that I was going to use. And then I would do, basically what I do is I'd use something like Sketch. So I'd cut out the different parts of the template that I was going to use, and then I'd assemble them on the page so that I'd say, you know, this is what it looks like now. You click on this, you know, now it looks like this. But I'd get really, really detailed. Now I'm a little better at HTML and CSS and whatnot, so a lot of times I'll just hand off, you know, something that, and I'll say, put this functionality behind this.
So if we were to get started right now, brand new piece of software, if we're not developers, the thing to do is to sketch it out as closely as possible to what the finished product needs to be.
I'd pick a theme that somebody's already designed that looks good, that, you know, you can go to Wrap Bootstrap or any of those, you know, themes, like, and I would use something like that instead of trying to come up with your whole own thing, which I did twice, which was dumb and didn't work very well.
Is wrapbootstrap.com. What they sell are themes for what? I've never seen these people before.
It's like admin themes for Bootstrap. So, and Bootstrap being Twitter's Bootstrap framework. There are other things. I don't want to just promote that, but there are other options that you can do. But the point is that, especially when you're starting off, the design is kind of, and if you're low budget, which I was, the design can be really expensive to get a good design done. So if you start off with something that's at least that's got the components that you need in order to make a thing work, then start with that. You can always, you know, deal with it later if you want to change it.
I see. It looks like I can have, oh, this is beautiful, some of these. There's something called Ace Responsive Admin Theme. It just looks like an admin panel would on software that someone in the audience might create. Right. And it has all the pie charts and the visualization of the data that they want. And I guess what they do is they would buy this for $18 and say to their developer, I want this pie chart and it should have this data. I want graph over here and should have this data. The rest of it kill because I don't need the rest. I just need to start with that. Got it. And so they have the design and they can easily communicate what they do. I think you could even probably import or copy and paste some of this stuff into Keynotopia so you can make it look like it would if it was actually working. This is a really good
that,
site.
But I haven't tried that, but I have used Keynote a bit.
You just use Keynote natively without Keynotopia to make it work? You just manually will do that?
Same way that I did it with Pages, yeah. I'd go to something like the theme that you're looking at now and just cut the sections that I needed into images, paste them into to Keynote, and then just assemble it like it was an app.
I see. Wow. Do you have any other resources like this? I really like this site.
None that are coming to top of mind right now.
Okay.
Sorry.
We met through Rob Walling, the guy who created Drip. GetDrip.com is a site. You said that speaking at his conference at MicroConf gave you legitimacy. How does speaking at a conference give you legitimacy?
I was undercover for a long time, which was another kind of big mistake that I made along the way. And what I mean by that was I sort of had like this bifurcated professional existence. So I was working with banks and selling their stuff and all that. But then I didn't really want to talk about what I was doing with them or with the other people who I was working with. And so I was really, I was under the radar for a long time.
Why?
I don't know. Now as I look back at it, it was silly. But I think at the time I was afraid that it would sink my existing business. Like that, I don't know. You know, I guess the same way that I was embarrassed about the PDF or whatever, I had some other concerns about this. Because these are people who I'm doing high-dollar transactions with, and, you know, I'm in their business. I've got fiduciary responsibilities. Do I want them to know that I'm playing software entrepreneur?
Oh, I see, because you maintained your career while you were building this business on the side, and it became gotcha. Okay, what was your career at the time? It wasn't the auctioneering that we talked about earlier. It was that?
That, and yeah, I did investment brokerage and auctioneering, yeah.
I see, okay. You're not doing it anymore?
No, I'm almost 2 years.
How long did it take you? It seems like it took about 2 or 3 years for you to get to the place where revenue from your business exceeded your salary.
Yeah. Yeah. And when I did that talk, it gave me an opportunity to kind of go back and look at what I had been doing with myself over the years. And I mean, I had periods where I don't know if I lost interest or I wandered off or, you know, all kinds of things like that. And so it took a lot longer than it probably should have.
To hit that number.
To hit a number where I could
walk. What do you mean you got lost and that kept you from hitting the number?
I got into things. I got shiny objects. I got distracted by all kinds of stuff along the way. For example, I discovered Twilio. I decided that I should definitely build a mobile marketing app that, you know, that local businesses can use. This is moronic.
Completely different from your business.
Totally.
But this opportunity came around. Twilio makes it so easy. Of course, they're going to need it. Got it. So you were doing all these. And once you stopped and focused just on real estate, just on these businesses, life got better.
Did. Yeah.
How long did it take you? Not how long. Where's the revenue now? Last year, what kind of revenue were you doing?
Last year, I did a little under 170, just about 170.
About 170,000.
Yeah, not huge numbers.
When you started out, what you were aiming for, that's solid. When you were starting out, what you were aiming for was a Ferrari as the goal. Now what's the goal? Now that you can buy a Ferrari, what do you really want?
Yeah, I don't think I can buy a Ferrari today. What I really am interested in today is just my freedom. I'm fiercely independent. I do not like having to be anywhere at any particular time or do or say things people want me to do or say. And it sounds maybe obnoxious, but I really like having control of my time and space and being able to be where I am doing what I want to do without having to worry about what other people need me to be doing.
I know. I want to find out about this trip that you and your family are taking, speaking of freedom and the things you can do. But, you know, you're a guy who was an entrepreneur, it seems, from an early age. Like me, you used to sell candy to other kids in your school. Do you remember what candy you sold and how you did it? I remember mine.
Yeah, Hot Picks.
What's Hot Picks?
Hot Picks were like these cinnamon-flavored toothpicks.
Okay.
I lived in, it was an arbitrage play. I lived in close proximity to where you could buy hot picks in kind of a rural town. And so I'd buy them for 10 cents for a pack of 10 and then sell them for 10 cents a piece. And that got shut down. But yeah, why? Things like that. Why? I don't know. You know, if it was my school, I wouldn't shut it down. I'd probably encourage it. No.
I hate that. This is one of the things that bothered me when I was a student. It bothers me that to this day, I still get emails from people who say that the same thing happened to them recently.
Yeah.
I mean, to younger people who just who are in high school and college will say it. If you were as a kid drawing, they wouldn't tell you stop drawing. They would put you in a class for drawing. If you were in a class singing, they wouldn't tell you never sing again. They would put you in a class for singing, for writing, for all those things, for science. Yeah. But when it comes to business, if you're selling these hot picks, they shut you down and they act like you're a criminal. You might as well have been selling cocaine in their eyes.
Oh, yeah.
But at least you didn't stop. You actually, at 15, you bought a shop. What was a shop?
Bought a bike shop.
So you actually can buy – how do you buy a bike shop at 15?
You borrow money from your grandparents.
Okay. How much does it take to buy a bike shop?
Well, in 1980 – what was that? Nine or something? Mm-hmm. 1989 – in Rowley, Massachusetts, it cost like $3,800, something like that. It was like a boxes of parts, some goodwill, the name and some connections to vendors, you know.
How did the bike shop do?
We did well. We did, I mean, considering that it's something that we were working, you know, nights and weekends and then summers or whatever, we did 10,000, then 20,000, then 40,000 in our 3 years. And then I went to school after that.
It's so freaking impressive that you would do that, that you would take on that responsibility, that you'd be able to run a bike store. How do you even run it when you're in school? Don't you have to be in class?
It didn't feel like that at the time, I guess. We just wanted to do it, and we had support, and so did it. It was hard. I mean, I guess you probably did the same thing. I've listened to enough of your interviews, I should know. But, I mean, I had a job from the beginning. If it wasn't a paper route, then it was like sorting bottles of cans, then I was doing something else. So this was just another way of work, another form of work. I didn't really consider it anything else. And, we worked nights and weekends, and then in the summer we just worked all the time.
Wow, and I see the bikes over your shoulder. To me, cycling feels like freedom, too. I love that.
Me too. It's my main outlet, for sure.
Is it? It's so hard to do it. At least here in San Francisco, I guess it's not that hard, but I hate riding with all the cars over here. It feels really dangerous. The only place I feel I can go long distance is over the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yeah.
And then once I get there, it's so. I feel even Oakland has better paths than here. And when I lived in LA, oh boy, I could show you so many different paths.
Yeah. I lived in San Francisco for a while. It was hard, but we got out of town, went up to Marin or went south.
And you drive up there to do your rides. Yeah. And then once you do, the roads are so narrow. There is no giant bike lane for you. Sometimes when I drive around there, I feel like I could crush a cyclist. I go so slow just to make sure that I don't hit them.
Yeah. Well, I'm more of a mountain biker now, but yeah.
I see.
That's what we did.
So I'm worried now that I have a son that I won't be able to travel as much as I did before, that I won't be able to do a lot. Like, frankly, today I'm going to head home soon after 5 o'clock. I think I have an interview that ends at 5 o'clock. I'll finish recording that. I'll answer one or two emails that are urgent before I leave, and then I'll rush right home, where before I would take my time.
Yeah.
And I worry that it's going to get worse and that I won't be able to do any traveling. And here you are. You've got something called nomadicbrood.com. You're doing something that most people without kids don't feel they could do. What are you doing, and how can you freaking do it? I want to know how to do it so I can do it.
Well, I don't know necessarily that I can do it, Andrew, but I'm gonna try and prove
you're committed enough that I can't believe you're gonna fail.
I'm committed. Yeah,
yes.
For sure. Yeah. So
what is it that you're doing for people who don't know?
So what we're doing is, I've been struggling with being up here. I'm in southern New Hampshire. I'm outside of Portsmouth, and there's a nice little tech scene. But it's not – the weather kind of sucks, and it's not the kind of tech scene that I'd like to be in. So we started thinking, well, maybe we should move, and where would we want to move? So we come up with a couple of places. We're thinking about Austin. And so then we said, well, if we're going to move to Austin, you know, what would that look like? Time-wise, well, like I said, I'd have to go out there. I'd have to buy a house. We're gonna, we've got to figure out all the logistics for getting everybody everywhere. And then we said, well, you know, why Austin? I guess it's just because we went there for a couple of weeks and we liked it, you know, and it's got a great tech scene and all that, and the weather is better.
Yeah.
But then we started saying, well, what if we didn't have like rules about that? What if we didn't have a time that we had to be there, or you know, we could just kind of figure out what we wanted to do? So that's what we're doing. We're liquidating everything right now, and we're packing into a gigantic van, and may or may not tow some kind of trailer and Airbnb it for a while.
How long's a while? A week? A month?
We're shooting for a year.
Wow. So how do kids go to school when you're traveling around like this?
We're going to road school. We're kind of blessed with... our kids don't have any challenges, that like educational challenges or anything like that. And so we don't have those concerns, I'll say. And so we've got programs, we've got curriculum, and we're going to take it on the road. And
road school, and meaning you and your wife are going to teach.
Yeah, that's what we're going to do. Yeah. I mean, you'd be surprised as we've got her second, my daughter, my oldest kid is my daughter. She's in second grade. You'd be surprised how much time they have in school that is just completely wasted.
Like, oh, I'm not surprised. You know, I remember it myself. It's when you're at your most energetic, they try to snuff out your energy. When you have so much that you could do, they send you to school and then you sit home in front of the TV because what else are you going to do?
Yeah. So, I mean, we're already plowing through, we're halfway through second grade with a lot of in on a lot of ways. And I'm talking to you here in, you know, 1 month or 1 week out of school. So,
wow.
So we'll see.
What's the hardest thing to liquidate?
I've got this vintage Land Cruiser that I love that I've cleaned up to sell a few times, and I'm just having a really hard time letting it go. Yeah.
Any chance you're just going to put it in storage?
There's a chance. Yeah. After yesterday, it looks really good. So there's a chance.
You know what? I did that. And I foolishly, I guess, who thought about it? I decided I was just going to go backpack through Europe. I put my car in storage. And because I didn't disconnect the battery, I had all kinds of trouble. You have to do a couple of things before you take off. You can't just park it and move.
Yeah. Yeah, it's eye-opening when you start looking around and realizing what your stuff is worth and all that stuff that you've accumulated. Like, why do you have this stuff? You know, as I'm going through, I've got things that, and I'm sure most people do, that I haven't looked at or touched in years, and they're just, you know, clogging up my space. I've been moving around, and so it's been pretty liberating to let a lot of stuff just go, you know.
I feel that way. Yeah. The place where people who want to find out about this can go is bootstrappedwithkids.com, and they can follow the adventure. It's more than that, but that's one of the things that you talked about there. Before I leave, I want to end with a couple of things here. The first is, we asked you in the pre-interview, April did, what is it that if someone wanted to learn from you, what advice would you give them? You said start with building an audience before you even sell. Why? Why the audience first?
I mean, that's where you engage. That's where you're going to learn about what you should even be selling and how you're going to sell it and what their problems are and everything else. And I kind of did that just because I was in the community, so I already knew a bit about it, but I would have done more. For sure. I mean, I don't think that there's anything more valuable than having an audience that is listening to like your every word, you know?
Yeah. The feedback you get from them is spectacular. The fact that when you first launch something, there are people who actually get to use it is incredibly helpful. The guidance that they give you, even if they don't end up buying from you, the fact that they can come in and say, here's where I would change it, or here's how I can help you make it, tremendously valuable. And then the final thing that you said was the book that you'd recommend other entrepreneurs who are listening to us go grab is The Ultimate Sales Letter by Dan Kennedy. Why The Ultimate Sales Letter by Dan Kennedy?
Because it gives you a real introduction. I think a lot of the sites that I see, people are not selling hard enough, probably. And I think that a lot of times they want things to look clean and nice, and they're just not selling hard enough. And I think that that's a good introduction for how to get started with selling in print. And that's how
selling
I started.
In print.
Selling in with a written word. Yeah.
I agree with you. It's we're not selling hard enough. We're embarrassed of what we're creating. We're embarrassed to sell, and to be surrounded by people who do it is incredibly helpful. Frankly, I put so much work into doing Mixergy back in the early days, and then when it came time to sell, I was so hesitant to sell anything at all. I even turned away sponsors. I would get emails from sponsors all the time. Many of them were listeners of Mixergy who would say, can I sponsor because I love the work? Can I sponsor because you're reaching people like me? And I'd say, no, I don't want to ruin the quality of the show. I don't want to do this. And you know, so hard. It's so hard sometimes.
I've been listening to your interviews for a long time. And a lot of the feelings that you have like that really resonate with me. I feel a lot of what you feel. So
I'm glad that you say that, because there are times when I used to feel that I was the only one who felt that way.
Yeah, no, you're not alone.
Well, thank you for listening. Thank you for being a part of Mixergy. Thank you for being Mixergy Premium, and now for doing something that I dreamed of when I was starting. You know this. I used to say, I hope that someone out there will listen to this interview, get something out of it, and come back here. And I used to say with conviction, because I really believed in it, but there was no basis for believing it. It was just this hope. And now here you are, you're doing this. And I can say to the audience that if they want to follow along with you and see your progress and just get to know you better, there's so many places I could send them to, because you're doing so much. You're not a consumer, you're a creator.
Thanks.
And they can go to nomadicbrood.com, right? They can go to, and I love this phrase, but first let me give the URL, bootstrappedwithkids.com, which is a podcast that you do where you talk about the entrepreneurial experience for someone who has SaaS but also has a family. And the phrase that you have up on the homepage that I love is, where ramen profitable does not exist.
Yeah.
Right? For like a 19-year-old entrepreneur who's starting out, as long as he's ramen profitable, the rest doesn't matter. You can afford to eat ramen. You can afford to live. Everything else is fine. If you can't feed your kids ramen, and you need other stuff for them. So, it's a whole other world, and I'm glad that someone's talking about it. And then what else do we have? The final site I guess I should send people to is distressedpro.com. That's where they can see the software that we've been talking about in the – and I think they could sign up for the course right there, right?
Yeah. Depending on which bucket you put yourself in, there's a few different ways you can get started. Yeah.
All right. It's a site worth checking out, even if you don't fully get it. Frankly, it's not. I don't know if it is for our audience or not. As far as I don't know how many people. I won't even say it. If you're listening to me, do you know what REO is? can you tell them what REO is?
REO is an acronym for real estate owned. It's a shortened version of OREO, which is other real estate owned, which is the line item on a bank's call report that says what real estate they own.
If you know what REO is, then you're really going to love distressedpro.com. If you don't, take a look at it, because I think it's just a well laid out website. I was trying to see what theme you use for WordPress for it, and then I did a inspect on it. And I saw that I think you created your own theme. It's called the Distress Pro WordPress theme or something. So I thought
it's customized. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really a well done site. All right. Well, thank you so much for being on here.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Thank you all for listening. And especially thank you, Rob Walling, for introducing us and making this interview happen. And frankly, Rob, for opening my eyes to many great guests and friends. All right. Thank you. Bye, everyone.